Welcome, everyone, to The Demand Side. I'm your host, Edward Brown. On today's episode, we're talking about the future of American capitalism, the health of U.S. citizens, and asking one big question. Is American capitalism killing America? Here to discuss is our very special guest, Angus Deaton. Professor Deaton is a senior scholar in the Dwight D. Eisenhower Professor of Economics and International Affairs Emeritus at the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. And he's a presidential professor of economics at the University of Southern California. His main research areas are in poverty, inequality, health, well-being, economic development, and randomized controlled trials. Professor Deaton is a corresponding fellow of the British Academy, an honorary fellow of the Royal Society of Edinburgh, a fellow of the Econometric Society, and in 1978 was the first recipient of the Society's Frisch Medal. And in 2009, he was president of the American Economic Association. In 2012, he was awarded the BBVA Foundation Frontiers of Knowledge Award. In 2014, he was elected a member of the American Philosophical Society. And in 2015, he was elected a member of the National Academy of Sciences. He was made a Knight Bachelor for his services to economics and international affairs. And in 2015, he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics. Professor Deaton, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
So, Professor, thank you so much for taking taking the time out to come on today. We're very happy to have you on the show. As I said earlier, we will be taking a look at how American capitalism has impacted America over the last few decades, and we will use your most recent book, Deaths of Despair, as a way to guide us through this topic. The book is just so fascinating because it sheds light on the pain so many Americans are suffering, pain that largely could have been avoided. For our listeners who haven't read the book, it examines death rates and causes of death here in America. And it notes that while falling death rates were one of the key features of the 20th century, things are now reversing. Deaths are rising, and they are not normal deaths. They are deaths of despair, deaths associated with suicide, opioids, and alcohol, deaths that are self-inflicted. But the book is also more than just an examination of deaths of despair. It's a critique of American capitalism, which I think is quite productive because it's our duty as capitalists to continually reevaluate capitalism, just as it's our duty as citizens to reevaluate politicians every time we go to the polls. But before we dive into some of the specifics of the book, Professor, why don't we have you talk a little bit about the book, why you decided to write about this topic, and how you went about answering some of the book's big questions.
Thanks. I'm very happy to do that. You know, I've been interested in inequality pretty much all my life. So that's the sort of big background issue of the extent to which some people are doing better than others. Capitalism is working for some. Capitalism is not working for others. And that's very much one of the big underlying themes of the book. But the book came out of a more specific piece of work, which is something that Anne Case and I had been working on from different points of view for quite a long time. So we were working on suicide, which we were interested in. She was working on pain on a sort of separate project. And then at some point, those two things came together, and we were trying to put together a paper for a conference on what had happened to suicides. And we discovered that for white non-Hispanic people in middle age, suicides have been rising quite rapidly. So that was sort of for our suicide paper. But then as background, we thought it'd be really good to look and see what's happening to all deaths altogether. And how big is this rise in suicides relative to other things that are going on? And that's when we discovered, just as a sort of background plot, we drew a picture of what was happening to all causes for white non-Hispanics in middle age. And that's when we discovered deaths of despair. And we discovered that these mortality rates were rising, which is really never supposed to happen. Total mortality rates were rising, which is not supposed to happen. And then we cried beneath that. We knew about suicide already, but that's when we tumbled onto the opioid epidemic and onto these diseases from alcohol, liver disease. I think the term deaths of despair came somewhat later, and gave an interview with Wirtz, I think, in which he thought the term deaths of despair was a really good term for covering these three deaths. And in fact, it seems to have pretty much entered the vocabulary. I mean, in some sense, the greatest compliment is when people cite deaths of despair without mentioning us. It's just become a term of use. So then we thought, okay, this is expanding. We're tracking this back. Why are these things happening? Is it something to do with the way the economy is running, that society is running? And that investigation led us into the book, Deaths of Despair and the Future of Cannibalism. So that's the background.
I think our listeners are probably, because they haven't read the book yet, most of them, are still having a trouble visualizing the extent of this problem. And you do a really good job at the beginning of your chapter on suicides, drugs, and alcohol, explaining just how bad this problem is. You say, in 2017, 158,000 Americans died from what we will call deaths of despair, suicide, overdoses, and alcoholic liver disease. That is the equivalent of three full 737 MAX airplanes falling out of the sky every day with no survivors. By comparison, there were 40,100 traffic fatalities in 2017, a number that is lower than the number of suicides alone. Professor, when we think about it in that light, it's clear that we have a pretty big problem. But let's talk about who these people are. Who are the ones that are dying? What are their demographics? Where in the country are they located? And I guess what has happened that has made them want to, in one way or another, take their own lives?
Okay, well, the major thing that we found about who they are, and we found that in the very first paper, was that these are almost the rise in deaths of despair. I mean, you know, in normal times, there's some people who kill themselves. There's some people who die of overdoses. Some people who die of alcoholic liver disease. But this big increase since the late 90s has basically come among people who do not have a four-year college degree. So that the third of the population that has a bachelor's degree are more or less exempt from this. And that's really a big deal. You know, because if people were just dropping opioids from the sky and everybody was picking them up and, you know, swallowing them or whatever, then you'd expect everyone to die. But it's much more specific than that. And that, of course, gives you a clue as to what really might be behind these people, behind these deaths. Now, we started with people in midlife, you know, people in 45 to 54. But as we track that over time, it's moving down the age distribution. So it's got bad among people younger than that. And the younger people in their 20s and 30s are now among the worst affected by these people. It's not much affecting the elderly. So it's sort of a new thing that started up in the mid-90s or so and is spreading from midlife down. Of course, these midlife people are moving into old age, and so if they take this with them, then this problem will be there. In terms of where they are in the country, the people often talk about white non-Hispanics living in the countryside, but it's happening in the cities too. One of the worst places is Baltimore, for instance. It used to be just white non-Hispanics, but in more recent years it's spread to black non-Hispanics too. And, you know, what has happened that has made them want to do this, that's something we have to talk about a bit more. We think their lives are coming apart. And that's where we would locate the potential failure of capitalism for those people.
What is so interesting is that and you talk about this in the book, is that the data almost hide what is going on. You said, taken as a whole, white mortality in the age group 45 to 54 has held constant since the early 1990s. But this masks the fact that for those with less than a bachelor's degree, death rates rose by 25%. While for those with less than a bachelor's degree, death rates rose by 25%. While those with a bachelor's degree, mortality dropped by 40%. This is just fascinating.
And it's just, this is the big inequality division in America today, as far as we're concerned, that, you know, some people's lives, if you like, the educated elite. And it's only a third of the population. It's very, very important to remember that. It's the third of the population who have a bachelor's degree or better. When I say have a bachelor's degree, you know, that includes the PhDs, the people who have been to business school, all the rest of it. But when you said that white mortality in the age group 45 to 54 has held constant since the early 90s, that in itself is a pretty bad thing. Because if you plot it back to 1930 or something, this has been pretty steadily falling. I mean, there have been periods where, you know, people who started smoking in the 30s and 40s, you know, lung cancer caught up with them in the 60s, where it sort of flattened for a bit. But this is a very, very unusual event for something like this to happen. And, you know, when you put this together with the slowing down in the death rate of cardiovascular disease, you know, life expectancy as a whole in America fell for 3 years. And that was the first time since the great influenza pandemic of 1918-19. And of course, it's not last time because we're in the midst of a pandemic now. And life expectancy has certainly fell in 2020 compared with 2019 and may stay pretty low in 2021, though it'll bounce back again after that. So, you know, COVID is overlaid on this, that, you know, which, you know, is also splitting people by education levels and by race in somewhat different ways from what we described in the book.
Right. Well, let's talk about where the pain is coming from. You document how more and more Americans are reporting that they are in pain, which is really surprising, given that American jobs have shifted dramatically from more physical labor occupations of the 20th century to less physically demanding service sector jobs. And, you know, logically, this would make me think that their pain isn't coming from work and that it's, you know, psychological rather than physical. So if it's not on the job pain, where is their pain coming from?
Well, that's a really, really good question. And we've wrestled with that and we don't really know the answer, but we have some ideas. First of all, for your listeners, probably a good thing to say that many people think, okay, you know, these people used to have nice, cushy jobs in factories. And now they're working in the Amazon warehouse or they're working in McDonald's or something. And so no wonder they're in pain. They're on their feet all the day and so on. But that just turns out not to be true. These factory jobs, you know, which we can romanticize now they're gone, were pretty dangerous too. And also, you know, working in the Amazon warehouse is not dangerous. You know, things happen. But on the other hand, you're not going to die in an Amazon warehouse. You know, my dad grew up in a mining town in Yorkshire, in England, and his father was killed by a truck in the mine there. There's no mine there anymore, but there is a very large Amazon warehouse, and people do not get run down by runaway trucks in the Amazon warehouse. Right. So that people have studied that in detail, and it seems like these jobs, much as we may think of them as not being great jobs, and many of them are not, I certainly wouldn't like to work in an Amazon warehouse. They don't injure people. So the pain can't really be attributed to things that happen at work. A lot of it is lower back pain, which no one really seems to understand or know how to treat. There are lots of quacks out there. There are lots of docs who'll give you surgery or pain or whatever. But tracing this pain back is very hard. And our hypothesis in the book is people are feeling this pain because their worlds are coming apart, because their social life, their social capital, all the things, the churches, all the things that made their life worth living are failing them, so that these institutions are falling apart. And a lot of that pain is sort of, if you like, it's psychological. It's certainly not, it's certainly physical pain.
Right.
But then the pain researchers have pretty much abandoned the sort of Cartesian idea of pain, that, you know, it's something to do with something hurt you. All pain is in the mind. And, you know, the pain circuits can be activated by a lot of things other than someone stamping on your foot.
Right. I think one thing we need to sort of keep in mind is that the suicide rates of U.S. white men and women is a global outlier. You talk about how, you know, all around the world suicide rates have been falling. And unfortunately, some economists have tried to explain, you know, American suicides in a rather crude way, saying, you know, people kill themselves to maximize utility. You know, dying is bad, but living a life of suffering is much worse. So, I guess my question is, why are Americans suffering so much more than people of other developed countries? You just mentioned the importance of protective institutions like marriage and being a part of a religious community, and of course holding a job is good for mental health, and that many people are now detached from these institutions, and that of course increases the risk of suicide. Is the trend being seen in other developed countries of people becoming detached from these institutions, or is it just an American problem? I'm just trying to figure out why Americans are suffering so much more than people in other developed countries.
Well, we've been trying to figure that out too. It's not clear that we really have the answer. Let me defend my tribe just a little bit. It's very easy to say that Joan of Arc was maximizing utility when she allowed herself to be burnt at the stake, sort of idea. But the kernel of truth in that idea is that, and what it predicts is that suicide should rise with age. Because if you get to be old and you've got some terminal, crippling, incredibly painful disease, you can understand why people might choose to do away with themselves rather than live in such circumstances.
Right.
But, you know, that's not what we're seeing here. It's not like America is getting older, or it is getting older, but that's not what's driving the suicide rate. So what we're seeing these suicides is people, you know, killing themselves in midlife, and increasingly so among young people too. And, you know, Durkheim, who's seen as the father of sociology, you know, who wrote more than 100 years ago, talked about, you know, that people commit suicide when the institutions in their lives don't support them anymore, or if you like, they've lost their place in society. So it's a social phenomenon, and that's why Durkheim is seen as the father of sociology. And it's to do with your place in society having come apart, having come adrift of that. And so that would predispose people to suicide because there's no meaning left in their lives and lives are not worth living. So why in America and not in other countries? Well, traditionally, you know, the suicide capitals of the world were the countries in Eastern Europe. You know, and you know the Russian satellites and all the rest of it, and it doesn't take a lot of imagination to imagine why things might be bad there. But you know, those rates in those countries have been falling. They're still high, but the U.S. is going up to join them, as it were. And wow. we're other countries, other Western countries have been sort of declining. We don't know what's happened during COVID, but we suspect that suicide rates have gone down during COVID. And, you know, COVID's often been compared to being in a war. And there's good literature that during wartime, suicides go down because there's a very strong feeling of solidarity. You know, you have an outside enemy to work against, and you can pull together with other people. So it increases your internal support in society and gives you a common enemy to fight against. So that's, you know, that's we think that might be reversed, at least for the time being. We hope it continues. The other country where there was a huge amount of suicide was women tend not to commit suicide by a quarter of the rate of men. And the exception to that was China, where women in China committed suicide more than men. And that was more or less rural women. And the feeling was that they lived incredibly miserable lives. And that has diminished enormously too. So, you know, suicide's going down all around the world, except in America and maybe even in America during COVID. But it's not a good sign. I mean, it's a sign that society's not working very well. And again, this rise, I keep harping on this, but it's the people without a VA.
Right.
And that's becoming this incredible division. You know, economists, when they talk about inequality, think of income inequality and maybe wealth inequality. But this is this sort of societal inequality, for which the marker seems to be the BA degree. It's sort of like in the book, I think we talk about people having to wear the scarlet letters on their chest.
Right, right.
With the letters BA crossed out through it. And then those people are sort of like second classes.
Yeah. And what was interesting in the book is, you know, you said that we can't blame globalization or technological change on these deaths because other rich countries face the same challenges. I mean, we always like to talk about how globalization has really uprooted things, and it has. But those the other developed nations have not seen the long-term wage stagnation or an epidemic of deaths of despair. You know, you talked about in the book how other countries are still very much enjoying the benefits of the blue collar aristocracy. What have those countries done that we haven't?
Well, I don't think we know for sure. And I'm not sure that the threat to the blue-collar aristocracy is unique to America. You know, throughout the rich world, the unionization is going down. That working class culture is under threat. If you look at it in Britain, recently, you know, Boris Johnson was elected with support from these traditional working class blue collar towns, including the one I talked about already, which is where my father grew up, which is when he was there, when I was a kid, they would no more have voted for a conservative than, you know, even the thought would have got you punched in the face. And now they feel like this working class sort of blue-collar successfulness or success is really not really there anymore. So I think that's happening everywhere, that there's a threat to traditional white working classes, if you like. And, you know, these countries have immigration, they have globalization, they face a lot of the things we face. Some of them have been, like Germany, been much more successful at dealing with globalization than we have. They imported a tremendous amount of stuff from China, but they also exported cars. I mean, I remember being in the private parking lot in a Chinese airport two or three years ago, and every single car parked there was a German-made car.
Wow.
So, you know, they made a deal, and we don't seem to have been able to do that to the same extent. But, so here's some hypotheses. One is this, we've had a 50-year decline in median wages for people without a VA, men without a VA. So if you look, that's a terrible thing. I mean, since the 70s, sort of idea. So, you know, if you treat people badly enough for long enough, they're going to get upset and they'll do things like vote for Donald Trump or, you know, rebel in some way. So that's, and other countries have had wage stagnation. Britain's had it for quite a long time, but nothing like 50 years. I mean, you're talking about 5 years or 10 years and they're very worried about it, but not 50 years. So our period is longer than theirs. Secondly, and my friends on the left argue this quite a lot, they have a much better developed welfare state than we do. And, you know, I'm sure that's part of the story. How big a part of the story, I don't know. But, you know, the story that we tell in the book is one in which the cost of healthcare is eating us alive. And, you know, that's something that we can talk about a bit more.
Yeah. You know, one thing about, I want to talk about trade for a second. You talk about in the book how trade can bring new jobs with increased wages and that successful cities stay successful by being the homes for those new jobs. But unfortunately, the less educated, those without the bachelor's degree, are really unable to participate in that process. You know, trade policies have gutted smaller cities and rural areas, and the displaced workers really have nowhere to go because they would be worse off if they took their skills to a more talented area with, you know, a higher cost of living. So, you know, are we doing anything really to help these people? Are politicians just leaving them behind?
I think they are. And that said, it's not entirely clear what you would do to make this better. Some of us think that industrial policy really needs to be revived, and that many of the employers in some of those places are holding down wages. But the phenomenon that you talk about, which is correct, is that, you know, less educated people used to say, get on your bike, you know, get out of this dying town, get a removal van, get a U-Haul, and head off to one of those successful cities. And as you said, you can't do that anymore because the cost of living there is so high and the jobs are just not paying enough to make it up. So what, you know, one of the things, if I were further to the right than I am, and there's some truth here, is that the market may look after this in time, in that some of these places are very attractive places for immigrants to come and live, for new businesses to open up, where wages are low, and where you might be able to do things. I mean, it's obviously not going to be high-tech stuff, because the high-tech stuff, you know, requires lots of other people with high skills. But nevertheless, there's a powerful force there which might revivify some of these towns. I also think there's a lot of these towns that have been devastated by the opioid epidemic. There may be some signs that they're learning to rebuild social capital in a way that will pick them up. There's a new book by Sam Quinones, who wrote Dreamland about opioids, that's in press, I think. And he finds a lot of signs of, very hopeful signs of that happening, with towns sort of rebuilding their social capital and their institutions. And that sort of happened after the crack epidemic in the inner cities in America. And maybe it will happen here. I think also we just got to make healthcare much cheaper. I mean, that would help all of these things. And it would help states, you know, fund the sort of educational opportunities that they don't fund to the same extent anymore.
Well, let's talk about opioids specifically, and then a little bit about the healthcare system in general. You said in the book that by 2012, enough opioids were written for each American adult to have a month's supply. In 2015, more than one third of all of adults were prescribed opioids, 98 million people. And in 2017, opioids prescribed by physicians accounted for a quarter of all drug overdose deaths. the cumulative total of prescription opioid deaths from 2000 to 2017 is greater than the total number of Americans who died in the two world wars. But you also note that opioid deaths, like other deaths of despair, are not equal opportunity. Overdose deaths involving illegal and legal opioids are predominantly of Americans who don't have the bachelor's degree. So, Professor, what's going on here? Is it that more educated people know the dangers of opioids and stay away? Or is it that more educated people have more to live for? What do you think is happening?
Well, I think both of those stories are to some extent true. That, you know, there's this very strong correlation there's always been between education and health. And some of it is more educated people, for whatever reason, tend to take better care of themselves. And so they're perhaps less tempted by these drugs. But I think the much, and so that's one part of it. The other part is that, you know, the thing we've already talked about, which is, you know, in many of these towns, in many of these places around America, you know, people have lost the institutions that supported them. And you know, their marriages are coming apart, they're not going to church anymore, all of the jobs are not there anymore. And I think the real horrible thing that happened was the pharma companies targeted those communities. And, you know, that's why they're now paying enormous damages to states and cities all around America for the harm that they did. They knew these people were really suffering. Many of them were actually physically suffering too, because they might have worked in the mines or they might have worked in factories where they were injured. But they went to these towns where people had very little live for it and pumped drugs in there. So they were just like drug dealers. And, you know, that was just, I mean, we're sort of used to it now, but the idea that capitalism should be running away, that, you know, a bunch of pharma companies are making huge sums of money out of addicting and killing, you know, people who've lost their livelihoods. I mean, that's the most appalling indictment of America. And it's not an indictment of capitalism. I mean, it's that capitalism has to be regulated. And this was being regulated in reverse. The politicians were protecting those people. And sometimes it was the politicians, even from the areas where their constituents were dying, you know, who stopped the Drug Enforcement Agency or other agencies going after those people. So that's just a huge scandal that should never have happened.
Right. You know, when we look at the economics of this, you say that in the book that the supply side of the epidemic was important. The pharma companies and their enablers in Congress, the doctors who were imprudent with their prescriptions, but so was the demand side, the white working class, less educated, who already lived distressed lives, were fertile ground for corporate greed, a dysfunctional regulatory system, and a flawed medical system. And that this is sort of emblematic of American capitalism today. It fits the theme of serving businesses and owners at the expense of ordinary people. So, Professor, the big question is this form of American capitalism killing America?
Well, I don't think it's emblematic of American capitalism. You know, that's putting it too finely. You know, this is a really disgraceful part of American capitalism that should never have been allowed to happen. So it's, if you like, capitalism with American characteristics, if you can compare it with the Chinese. And you know why it didn't happen in other countries? Other countries regulate their pharma companies.
Right.
You know, so it's, if you like, you know, I could argue it's not, you know, I believe in competitive markets. You know, I believe that we ought to be harnessing the power of competitive markets. But, you know, we stopped people handing out. Remember, there were scandals in the old days of people who used to hand out tapeworm ads and slimming aids. Right? Yeah. They were just great, you know. And we don't allow that stuff anymore. We shouldn't have allowed people to prescribe these opioids. And, you know, in European countries, they use opioids if you've had a hip replaced or you're in pain in the hospital, but they don't send you home with buckets of this stuff. things. So you can get addicted. And, you know, now the docs have pulled back from this, but it sort of ignited a secondary epidemic. And now it's not just white non-Hispanics, but blacks too, and fentanyl and meth in various form has moved in behind it. And we've got a real problem on our hands. We had a real problem on our hands before. Right. And it's now, if it were, completely out of control.
Yeah. Well, let's shift a bit. We've discussed, you know, what has happened. Let's talk about, or try to think about how and why it happened. Why, you know, has the real value of take-home earnings fallen? Why have working conditions deteriorated? Why does America spend more on healthcare than any other nation, yet life expectancy is falling? You know, why has American capitalism failed so many?
Well, I mean, I do think that capitalism need not fail. And, you know, we've allowed, and I think our political system and the way it's funding has a lot to answer for. So, you know, the opium dealers, the pharma companies are just the worst part of this. But the whole healthcare industry, you know, which is all over the world, there's a problem with healthcare. Healthcare is just very hard to provide. You know, can Arrow in the middle of the 20th century explain why you can't do this? Because competitive markets don't work when there's extreme asymmetries of information between providers. And so there's always the danger that you're going to run this system for the benefit of the providers, not for the benefit of the patients. And that's really what's happened. I mean, it happens everywhere. But we choose not to regulate it because we don't believe in regulation to the same extent. And so this thing is sort of out of control. And that's what would happen if you apply a sort of free market ideology to this part of capitalism that can't really function that way. And so you get this industry that's running on behalf of the providers. It's giving us very poor levels of health, and it's costing nearly 20% of GDP. And, you know, we saw an example of that the other day when there was this new drug for Alzheimer's, which it's not very clear whether it works or not. What is clear, it's going to cost enormous sums of money. And, you know, the prescription is going to cost like $56,000 a year. It needs a lot of ancillary medical equipment, which will take the cost per patient to over 100,000. And there may be 2 or 3 million people who will take that. Well, you know, we just can't, and it probably doesn't work. So this is sort of emblematic of an unregulated system. You know, capitalism is supposed to, competition is supposed to bring, you know, the prices of things in conjunction with their social value. But if you let the healthcare system run away with like this without controlling prices, without controlling something of the sort, this is the sort of catastrophe you're going to get. Most countries don't approve things unless they're value for money. So that Alzheimer's drug is not going to run in Britain, for example, and they're not going to pay that amount of money. Here, you know, laws have been passed which prevent us from regulating that. And so it's this corruption, this legalized corruption, this rent-seeking working through politics, which is sort of undermining a true competitive economy.
Yeah, I mean, it's just amazing that we fail to understand that free market competition can't deliver socially acceptable healthcare. And we fail to see the spillover effects into the from that sector into the entire economy. You know, doctors go to school for quite some time and accrue a large student debt burden, but their salaries are just disgusting. American doctors make twice as much what doctors make in other developed countries, yet Americans aren't any healthier. Our hospitals are now run by executives, not doctors. And healthcare advertising has become a major expense for hospitals and pharma companies. And all of this gets billed back to the patient in one way or another. It's almost sadistic. So, you know, when we look at this from a labor market point of view, because the cost of healthcare is so high, it just makes hiring a worker so expensive for business. And you know, I reading your book, I realize that it may be crude to say that the reason incomes and wages have stagnated in America is because of the American healthcare system, and that all the deaths of despair are a result of the healthcare system. But it sure does seem that that's the root cause.
Well, it's certainly, if it's not the root cause, it's very close to the root cause, you know, because as we talked about earlier, other countries have handled this globalization, this change in the structure of the economy without having these disasters. But we have this monstrous healthcare system in the way. And what you said is that people don't understand how it's being paid for, because people think their employers are paying for their healthcare. I don't pay for my healthcare, Princeton University pays for healthcare, sure. You know. Uh-huh. But I'm a very high paid worker. And so what Princeton has to pay for my healthcare is only a tiny fraction of my salary, so they can sort of shrug it off. But if I'm, you know, a hospital porter or an elevator operator, or I work in the mailroom or transport, you know, my salary is about the same size as what, you know, what I'm worth to the company is about as much as the healthcare costs.
Right.
And because healthcare costs of insurance don't change that much between, you know, low paid workers and high paid workers, because you're insuring health in all cases. And so this is just prohibitive for people at the bottom of the, you know, less educated labor market. And that's why so many of these jobs just don't exist in large corporations anymore. So that's a part of it. You've got these local authorities who, you know, don't want to pay for higher education anymore, which means, you know, another route to opportunity is being checked, you know, closed down for ordinary kids. And, you know, we've got a very, very dysfunctional system here. Meanwhile, as you say, these executives who run the hospitals are taking home huge numbers, you know.
Yeah.
And the Sacklers, even after Purdue Pharma got closed down, got to keep between $4 and $10 billion of their should be illegally manufactured. You know, if those were Mexican drug dealers, we'd execute them. But the Sacklers, so the Queen gives them both knighthoods, and you know, they're respected citizens. So this is not working very well.
No, it's not. So what are some things policymakers can do to alleviate the pain and suffering so many Americans now face? Is nationalized healthcare the answer? Is it really that simple? Or are there other things that need to be done as well? What is your prescription, Professor?
Well, I'm sort of trying to stay within the bounds of feasibility here. So, you know, I don't want to say nationalized healthcare, because that's not the only option. You know, the public option, which Joe Biden promised us in his when he was running for president, would help a lot, because you can control costs there and you get the market mechanism to work a little bit. And the, you know, employers might switch their healthcare out of employment and put people in the public option. And, you know, there's a route there that might work. And, you know, other countries have a whole range of healthcare systems, many of which involve the market, in one way or another, but all of which are really regulated. So you have to have everybody covered, and you have to have price control in some shape or form. And the problem is that these mechanisms that we've been talking about, and as you correctly said, they're so hidden from ordinary people, you know, and even people who really ought to know better say that healthcare is great, you know, it provides all these jobs. And why do you attack healthcare, you know, and all that sort of stuff? Because the way in which it's sucking the blood out of the American economy is not particularly well. I think, you know, I'm very sympathetic to the broad ideas that Joe Biden is trying to push in terms of, you know, building a sounder safety net. I don't really believe you can do that by taxing the rich, you know, though I'm not opposed to that. And I'm also not opposed to giving the IRS enough money to make people pay the taxes they owe.
Exactly.
But I think, you know, Europeans do this by having a value-added tax. And value-add tax is often denounced on the left as being regressive, which it sort of is. But it's not as if the tax system we have right now is tremendously progressive. And the great thing about a value-add tax is it's sort of like we all pitch in together and we all get something out of it together. Right. And so I like that. And I think it would be possible to build political coalitions about a value-added tax if it weren't completely off the table, which it seems to be. So there's a couple of ideas. Control healthcare costs somehow, public option maybe.
Right.
And think seriously about having a value-added tax to fund an expanded safety net.
Yeah, I've been in favor of a VAT for quite some time. It just opens up so many possibilities because it's a great way to raise revenue. Well, Professor, thank you so much for joining us today. I know our listeners and I have learned so much from you, and we thank you for taking the time out of your schedule to join us.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed talking with you. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks.
If you want to get more Angus Deaton, his book Deaths of Despair and the Future of Capitalism is available on the Demand Side's library page. And if you want to access all of Professor Deaton's research, visit princeton.edu. Professor Deaton, thank you again. Well, that's it for us here at the Demand Side. I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Is Capitalism Killing America? With our very special guest, Angus Deaton. Make sure to check out all the episodes of The Demand Side on The Demand Side's landing page, wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to visit thedemandside.com for access to opinion pieces, books, news, and videos. Thank you all for joining us today. And remember, if you're forced to choose sides, always choose the demand side. Until next time.